From WHQR Public Media, this is The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for joining us. On today's show, we're unpacking the forum we put on earlier this month with WECT and Port City Daily, featuring candidates running for the New Hanover County Board of Commissioners. As in past years, we structured this forum around questions from our collective listeners, viewers, and readers, from audience members who attended the event, and from our newsrooms. WHQR's questions, in particular, were based on our community agenda, which surveyed hundreds of community members from a diverse cross-section of backgrounds and political views. You can find more about our community agenda project in the show notes. For this year's commissioner's race in New Hanover County, we have 3 seats up for grabs and 6 candidates. We've got 3 challengers, including Republican John Hinnant, who ran a tough race for State House 2 years ago, and Democrats Cassidy Santaguida, a political newcomer, and Stephanie Walker, who is wrapping up a 4-year term on the New Hanover County School Board. We also have 3 incumbents. Democrat Jonathan Barfield Jr., the longest-serving member currently on the board, first elected in 2008. Republican Bill Rivenbark, currently the chairman, who left halfway through a term on the school board to run successfully for commissioner in 2020. And Republican Dane Scalise, who was appointed last year to fill the seat vacated by the tragic death of Deb Hayes. And just a note here, Rivenbark and Scalise did not attend our forum. Scalise let us know he had a scheduling conflict the week before the event, but he did answer a candidate questionnaire, and you can find his responses at WHQR.org, along with answers from all of the other candidates except Rivenbark. Rivenbark told me personally he would attend, after noting some concerns about getting fair treatment. But he didn't offer an explanation for his absence before or after the forum, and didn't return phone calls asking what happened. All right. So 4 candidates showed up, and with the help of WECT's John Evans, who emceed the forum, we put the candidates through their paces. With me now to help unpack what they had to say is my colleague, Kelly Kinoyer. Kelly, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's get right into this. A lot of this forum was built around umbrella questions. This is where we ask the same question for every candidate. And up first was a topic we've talked about a lot this year, development.
This is exactly the question we asked the candidates. Development is at the top of mind in the Cape Fear region with a housing shortage and many residents sick of, quote, overdevelopment. Public officials often plan to support so-called smart development. So what is your stance on the balance between filling our need for affordable housing and maintaining a community residents want to live in? So first up, we're going to hear the answer that we got from candidate Stephanie Walker, a Democrat running for county commission.
I saw a recent study that talked about how we were the number one metro area for new units, but it has not brought the prices down. So we have to think about how we have a variety of options for folks, especially that live here, that can't afford to live here anymore. A lot of teachers, a lot of folks actually don't live in the county because they can't afford to do it. So we really need a lot more options. We need to figure that out within the community, the commission, but also regionally, we need to really have a discussion about it.
So 2 things I want to say about this response. 1, she's definitely put her finger on part of the issue that we hear about a lot. It's just people getting priced out of the county and having to commute back into the county to work, which is part of our transportation problem, which we'll get to later in the show. But also that this answer, while it grasps the problem, doesn't really offer any solution.
That's true. I will point out that she also mentioned teachers. This is close to Stephanie Walker's heart, being a current member of the school board. A lot of the reason I think that she's running for the Board of Commissioners is because she has watched the budget fight between the county and between the school board for many years. And I think she kind of wants to get a hand on the budget at the county level because she's concerned about a lack of resources. So the teachers coming up makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. And 1 quick note, Stephanie Walker was one of only 2 school board members out of 2 out of 7 who voted for a more expansive, larger budget for the school board that was shot down by the board's Republican majority. So if she's frustrated, it's understandable.
Next up is Republican candidate John Hinnant.
We find is a lot of neighborhoods, established neighborhoods, when somebody comes in with a dense development adjacent to their neighborhood, they're opposed to it. And I want to protect the integrity of the existing neighborhoods. Smart development also includes increased transit. And then the thought is that it protects undeveloped space as green space. But if you don't control that green space, it's not going to be protected. So it's going to cost money to either preserve, protect, conserve, or make a park space or green space.
So earlier in his comment, Hinton also noticed that, you know, in his sense of smart development, it means denser, taller, developments. And he's actually been part of some of the adaptive reuse of some of the motels on Market Street that got a lot of NIMBY pushback from residents in those neighborhoods. So he knows the tension that he's talking about here, where we know in sort of an academic sense how to do smart development. You want to build taller and denser. That way it works for public transportation. And the more you build up, the less you build out, the more green space you save. But he's also gesturing to this protecting neighborhoods idea, which is, when you ask a candidate if they're in favor of taller, denser development, they'll often say yes. And if you ask them where they want to put it, that's where it gets tricky.
Yes, absolutely. I will say I have seen Mr. Hinton at a lot of forums that we've put on around development before he ran for county commission. So I know that he has been pretty involved in following this topic. You'll see that he talks a lot about supply and demand. He's got his hands in real estate a little bit. So I think he's pretty aware of the exact way that all of this works. I'd be very curious if he were to get into elected office, whether he would be in favor or opposed to development in a lot of these areas. I don't think we get a clear answer of that from this answer in the forum.
I agree. But to be fair, that's symptomatic of many candidates we've spoken to.
That is true. All right, next up is Democratic candidate Cassidy Santaguida.
We need to be intentional about what our vision is for the county. Where do we need to build with higher density? Where do we not need to build? What do we need to consider when we are looking at transit and transportation? Where do we have infrastructure in the county that will allow for us to build in smart ways? We also need to start looking at the cumulative impact of development rather than just taking a look project by project over what's going to happen in terms of transportation and impact on infrastructure and schools.
Now, I think this is a fairly interesting answer, particularly because she's gesturing at where the county has built new infrastructure in the community. There's been a lot of push for new infrastructure to get built in the northern part of the county. And so this sounds like she's saying there should be more density in places that the county has already invested in, which is quite interesting. She's also saying that there's kind of been a project by project approach, which is definitely true. And I think that a lot of folks will say, I know that this apartment complex is only supposed to add 100 trips, but there have been five other apartments before this. She's gesturing to that too. I'm not sure that there's a specific policy view here, but I know that in her written responses, when we've asked her about development, she's talked about wanting the sustainability manager for the county to get eyes on a lot of these major projects and to have a hand in deciding what's appropriate in the county.
Yeah, I know we've seen situations where there'll be a development up for a vote and across the street there will be another development in the work, but because they haven't broken ground yet or they're not quite shovel ready yet, they're not even considering it. And so that lack of sort of more regional, practical, big picture thinking has frustrated a lot of people. I'll also say the last frontier, as the county is calling the northern part of the county, is still an opportunity to approach development in a different way if people want, in that county's planning staff had long imagined there being kind of mini downtowns throughout the northern part of the county. That would work for water and sewer. It would work for the existing roadways because counties can't build new roads. And it would work for mass transportation. And I think she's alluding to a lot of that.
Up next, we have incumbent commissioner Jonathan Barfield, who started his answer to this question by saying, everybody who wasn't born in this community, can you please raise your hands? And then everybody rose their hands and he said, you're the problem.
When I grew up here, we didn't have a traffic problem. We could get around town so very easily until you came. And I say that as a joke, but recognizing the beautiful quality of life that our community has to offer has brought so many people to New Hanover County because they want a piece of the pie, so to speak. You know, people often say we are losing our green space. And I remind folks that green space belongs to someone because they're a private property owner. The county's green space would be Early Gardens, Longleaf Park, the land that we own, but the other land that you see around here belongs to someone. And most developers are looking for as much density as they can possibly get to offset the cost of building in this environment. When you look at Brunswick County, they're growing rapidly, and I'm thankful that things are taking place in that place as opposed to our community at the pace that's happening in Brunswick County. But when you look at some of these new neighborhoods, homes are stacked on top of homes, and I live in an R15 neighborhood. I'm thankful to have enough space between me and my neighbor when I'm cooking a steak. They can't smell exactly what I have on my grill.
All right, just to explain, he mentioned R15 zoning there. That is a low-density residential area. Under the Unified Development Ordinance for the county, it's 10.2 units per acre maximum with a minimum of 35% open space.
Recently, Barfield has talked about the possibility, the logistical reality of fitting all of the people who are probably going to move into this region in the next 25 years, estimated at around 80,000 people, pushing our population well over 300,000, into New Hanover County proper. And he believes that it's just not possible. And I think if we continue to develop the northern part of the county the way that large real estate developers like D.R. Horton have in mind, then that is probably true. If you have eighth acre or quarter acre lots from, you know, basically north of Wilmington all the way to the Pender County line, there's just not enough property. But with denser development, you certainly could fit those people in. But as we saw, you know, in the last couple of candidate forums, especially in 2022, we saw a lot of people running on this, you know, against big development, against multi-use family. So Barfield is, at least in one sense, acknowledging that there's a lot of pushback to that, trying to master plan or even sort of gently steer what the northern part of the county looks like will take a lot of political will.
That is certainly true. I will just point out, though, it seems like Barfield is interested in addressing the affordable housing problem by having government kind of subsidize affordable housing, investing money into specific affordable projects, less so addressing the supply and demand issue of there just not being enough units for the number of people who are moving to the area, which is what drives up costs, supply and demand. So this is kind of an interesting take from him. He's saying, I like the houses that we're building now. I like the development pattern that we have now. And he didn't in this answer address the affordable housing issue. But we have seen that he's been interested in investing in affordable housing through his record and through his comments at planning and commission meetings.
But now I want to go to the next umbrella question, which is intimately related to housing, and that is transportation. So when people move into our region, they have to get around. They got to go to the grocery store and to work. And that has been the driver of our traffic apocalypse, as some people have, mild-manneredly put it.
So the exact question that we asked the candidates at the forum was this. The Cape Fear region is one of the fastest growing places in North Carolina, and we are projecting more than 80,000 new residents in the county by 2040. Traffic is already a major complaint for residents, so what do you see as the future of transportation in New Hanover County? Let's start with the answer from candidate John Hinnant.
How does new development incorporate workforce housing? And these are our entry-level careers. Police, fire, first responders, teachers, nurses, our hospitality industry. If we want to protect our tourism industry, we're going to have to make sure our tourism employees have a place to live in the area. So it's important that we get workers living closer to home. We certainly have to increase our investment in mass transit in the unincorporated area.
So that was an interesting response because he specifically was talking about putting transit in the unincorporated area rather than in the city or in any of the more densely populated areas. What we've heard from transportation planners is that putting stops near where there's a lot of people tends to be more effective because you need a big population base to be able to support a route. But maybe he's planning on putting a lot of housing in those unincorporated areas. It's a little unclear.
Yeah, I will say for context for all of these responses is that WAVE has a long and tortured history. It began as two separate public transportation agencies, one for the city, one for the county. The county has historically supported mostly what's called paratransit, which is a federally funded program, and has only funded, you know, a minority portion of the overall budget of WAVE. Now, that's changed in fits and spurts, and recently the county has put much more money into WAVE. But most of the routes exist in the Wilmington city limits. In fact, the highest speed routes, the ones that are most frequent, run between the Wilmington downtown business core and the hospital corridor. And so to get it to the point where there are enough people in a small enough area for mass transit to work, you cannot really make that happen with quarter acre lots, with R30. And even with R15, it can be difficult. And so one of the things WAVE has said is that in order to get routes that are consistent and reliable and popular, there have to be people to use them. And so that's why transportation is so intimately related with housing and development.
Absolutely. And he did spend quite a bit of time in his answer talking about affordable housing. He mentioned that he doesn't think affordable housing should be put out in those more remote parts of the county. And he also suggested he'd like to see developers create workforce housing in single-family homes.
I can say that Hinnant's experience with running WDI and being a part of the downtown business community has given him some insight into what it is like for downtown workers, which includes a lot of bartenders and servers and cooks and service industry workers in general. And it's a huge problem for people like that to afford transportation, to get to work on time, to find a place to park. So he does kind of understand that dynamic.
All right, next up, let's listen to Cassidy Santaguita's answer.
We have got to build a more robust public transportation system here in the county. I think the first step in doing that is getting community members and business leaders in the area back on the WAVE board so that they have a say in the future of where WAVE goes. Additionally, we need to look at alternative transportation methods like bicycles and pedestrians. And I think to address that, we need to focus and invest on continuing to connect all of the bike pathways and the pedestrian pathways that we have in the county. We need to think about everything that we can do to allow people to get where they need to go and not have it be in a car.
So this was an answer that was both addressing WAVE's needs as well as addressing pedestrian and cycling pathways, which is something that a lot of folks have said would be an amenity for folks who just want it for exercise, but also helpful for the transportation network.
I mean, I don't think, given the car-centric culture of southeastern United States cities, that it would make an immediate impact. But if you look at long term, you have to build these pathways before people expect to use them. Like if someone told me right now, hey, Ben, you should take your bike to work, I would say, no, thank you. I would like to live. But if these had been, you know, established long-running bike lanes where people understood how bikes and cars should interact, then that's a much more feasible answer.
As for the discussion about the WAVE board, the current makeup of the WAVE board and what it's been for several years since Julie Olson Bozeman was in office has been public servants primarily from the county but also from the city. So asking to maybe put new people on the board who are business-oriented or community members rather than public servants, that is an interesting change.
Yeah, it's been City Manager Tony Cottle and County Manager Chris Coudray who have kind of been like a triage interim board almost, because they brought WAVE from the brink of financial insolvency back to the place where they can actually start asking for larger investments and doing, you know, more intense routes and growing. So at some point, it would be very interesting to see the county revisit that board makeup.
All right, next up, we'll hear from Commissioner Jonathan Barfield.
Most buses were coming every 60 minutes, and you don't create choice riders when you have a 60-minute headway. In your major cities, the bus comes every 20 minutes, and every 20 minutes it creates choice riders. At the same time, the county, in my opinion, we have not invested what I would say our fair share in WAVE transit, recognizing that the drivers work for another company, not WAVE. They work for a unionized company. And the WAVE staff are the administrators that are there, and finding ways to increase funding there so we can hire more bus drivers for that particular company, but also getting more buses in would increase the headways and make sure we have 20-minute headways versus 60-minute headways.
So that was kind of an admission about the county's recent investments in WAVE transit. The county pulled back a lot of its investments in WAVE, and it's been looking to invest a little more in recent years. We briefly talked about some of the troubles in WAVE's past. You're welcome to go and read about that history at whqr.org.
Yeah, that's right. And I think Jonathan Barfield does put his finger on exactly what the transportation consultant experts at WAVE has gone to, in that if you want to build a ridership, then you need to have buses that are convenient. It can't be that you have to plan something out an hour ahead of time. It has to be closer to a New York City model where you basically go to the bus stop and a bus is there in the relative future. We should say it will probably never get to the point where public transportation pays for itself. This is kind of a delusional idea. Even the MTA in New York City loses money, but it's an economic generator. It helps people save money that they spend elsewhere in the economy. That's the argument that the MTA makes. And the idea here is that it helps with traffic congestion, which you would otherwise have to spend enormous amounts of money on right-of-way and expanding roadways and stuff. So it will, just to be clear, it will always be an investment from government to make public transportation work. It will never be a for-profit business. But in order to get enough people on the bus so that elected officials feel comfortable funding it, it does have to be convenient, and that's what he's getting at.
Next up, let's hear from candidate Stephanie Walker.
I think the city and the county have done a great job. Since I was younger, it was a lot harder to walk and bike. They've done a great job with the Cross City Trail. I think if we can improve that, keep improving that, which I know that they've done, I would like to see more of that.
I will add, she also mentioned she'd like to see a walkable replacement for the Cape Fear Memorial Bridge when that gets replaced.
And I think we are going to get that, although we are not there yet, so I don't want to overpromise. There's still about $250 million left to fund that project.
Let's move on to the taxes question, which was our last umbrella question for this particular forum.
So we initially got a little over our skis and tried to be fancy and do a show of hands. Would you or would you not support taxes? And the kind of mixed results of people like lifting their hand and lowering them made us realize that we hadn't phrased that in a smart way, because it's too complicated to say yes or no. It depends. What are you raising taxes for? By how much? So we kind of went back later during the forum and asked a more nuanced version, asking candidates, how do you feel about the possibility of a property tax increase?
Under what circumstances do you think it's worth doing? So let's start with the answer from Cassidy Santaguida.
When it comes to considering a property tax increase, I think it's going to be important to assess what we need, where we're going in the future, and understand that there are going to be times when the responsible thing to do is going to be to increase property taxes. But I think that's a decision that we need to weigh carefully and not just jump into as assuming that's the only way to get infrastructure in place.
So it sounds like she's interested in pursuing every other option first. Let's hear from John Hennin next.
I'm not a fan of raising taxes at all. I think that there's an important project that we need to be doing a better job of lobbying the state, and that would be the widening of Castle Lane Road. It's designed, it's ready to go, it's not funded. But what is funded on Castle Lane Road is the economic development incentives with GE hiring 500 new jobs. We have to do a better job of communicating to the state our needs on infrastructure, especially when it's tied to economic development incentive and projects.
So Hennin has been pretty consistent about saying he does not want to raise taxes. He said something similar in our questionnaire when we asked about the possibility of a bond referendum. I do want to note, though, that counties can't build roads. Now, there is infrastructure to be built, including the school bond I mentioned, but also things like water and sewer, which is CFPA, but the county has used ARPA money to fund that in the past.
What I'll say is he's also said that he's in favor of using incentives like infrastructure to support developers so that they build affordable housing. But the question of how to fund those kinds of investments, he didn't really answer here. He said he wouldn't raise taxes.
Yeah, I think it comes down to a philosophical decision about how you want to do stuff. I mean, there's a conservative point of view where if you can use things like tax breaks for a developer or, say, subsidizing water and sewer for a development park, that is better than using taxpayer money to directly build stuff.
And he did say he wants to see the endowment step in on this issue.
I think everyone would like the endowment to step in on every issue.
That is true. Next, let's hear from Stephanie Walker.
The fact of the matter is, things need to be paid for, and how do you do that? You can get the state involved to do a little bit more with schools. That would be really great. We have an endowment as well. As the eighth wealthiest county in the state, there are things that we can do that don't necessarily mean raising taxes, but there are things that we do need. We just talked about a bunch of them tonight. Schools, transportation, how do they get paid for? So I would like to see what is presented before I would make a decision on anything like that.
That does sound more like a willingness to raise taxes, but for specific projects, not just willy-nilly.
Yeah, and there are a lot of different ways you can raise taxes. You can just do an overall general property tax increase, or you could do a sort of specific bond that raises, a portion of your taxes goes to paying off that bond for a limited period of time. It's not just a permanent increase in the tax base. So, again, this isn't to say this candidate is going to raise taxes. It's about whether or not they're philosophically opposed to the idea, completely out of hand, or whether or not, for the right project, they might consider it.
All right, let's finally hear from Jonathan Barfield, our incumbent.
We have no need to raise taxes in our county. We have $300 million in an account from the sale of the hospital that will cover any future needs that we have for a long time. And right now we're bringing in roughly $12 to $15 million a year in interest on that money. And we've been reinvesting those dollars into things to keep our tax rate low. So right now there's nothing that we would need to raise taxes for, because we have an abundance of resources sitting right there. Unlike any other county in the state, no other county can say in this state that they have $300 million sitting aside in a revenue stabilization fund that will make sure that their revenues never have a problem for quite a long time.
So I want to unpack this a little bit, because I've seen some attack ads against Barfield online criticizing him for his willingness to raise taxes. And this came from discussions during the budget process that led into the passing of the county budget at the end of June. If you didn't follow these minute by minute, I don't blame you. They can be quite dry. But basically what happened was they did not have enough money in the coffers to fund all the programs they wanted. There were a lot of different suggestions about how they could raise extra money from other parts of the county without raising taxes. And Barfield ultimately said, look, I think these are good programs. I would be okay with raising taxes, but he would also be okay with digging into this $300 million revenue stabilization fund. Okay, if you haven't heard about this, this is a chunk of money that came from the sale of New Hanover Regional Medical Center to Novant. The county took the majority of it, $1.25 billion, and sent that to the endowment, which we'll talk about later. They also took $50 million and set that aside for mental health and behavioral stuff, and they took $300 million and put that in a separate account. Now, that is kind of in a lockbox. It takes four of the five commissioners to access that money, which means there has to be a tremendous amount of political will, and in the board's current makeup, bipartisan political will, to touch that money. So yes, the county has $300 million, which actually generates enough interest to, as Barfield suggests, put $10 to $15 million into the county's general funds and operating funds every year. But to get into that $300 million, everyone has to agree. And this year, that was sort of bandied about and pretty robustly shut down. So that's what's going on with the $300 million. He's not wrong, but it is not as easy as just tapping into a fund with a debit card.
I do think it's also worth pointing out the reval question, the revaluation of property in New Hanover County. We've seen a lot of property values going up in this community in the past 3 or 4 years. And coming up next year, we're going to see a revaluation of those properties. So the county won't have to raise the property tax rate to raise revenues because the actual value that's getting taxed is going to go up on pretty much every property in New Hanover County. So they can make what looks like a tax cut that actually increases revenue, which is what they did last time there was a revaluation.
Yeah, that's right. 4 years ago, because the county does this every 4 years, we saw property values on the county rolls, not like sort of on the open market, but on the county's appraisal rolls, we saw property values rise on average by about a third. That put over $100 million more money into the county coffers. So even though the tax rate went down, at the end of the year, your tax bill was actually higher. So one, that's something to look out for because the county sort of gaslit people 4 years ago by suggesting they were reducing taxes. They were reducing the tax rate, but your bill went up. So watch out for that. But it's also worth noting that the county could do both. They could reduce the tax rate and have more money for the programs they want to fund. So that's going to be a huge part of the budget conversation in about 7 months.
All right, so that's going to wrap up our umbrella questions for this segment. We're going to be right back after a quick break, and we're going to drill in on two candidates, Cassidy Santaguida and John Hinnan.
You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Shuckman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here with my colleague Kelly Kinoyer as we dig into two of the challenger candidates. This is Cassidy Santaguida and John Hinnant.
Let's start with Cassidy Santaguida. We asked each of the candidates very specific questions, either from the reporters who were in the room or from listeners and viewers of WCT or readers of Port City Daily. So Cassidy Santaguida got this question on how to improve quality of life for residents. And she ended up talking about how to plan for growth.
I think that it's incredibly important that we think about infrastructure and putting in infrastructure before we build, thinking about schools, thinking about traffic impacts before we make decisions about particular developments so that we aren't just building, you know, walls and ceilings for people to live in and then it's difficult for them to get around town. I think another thing that's really important in terms of quality of life is understanding that as we grow, we need a robust public transportation system in the region to help us get cars off the road. And that public transportation system needs to be something that serves both people who need to ride the bus and choice riders, people who want to ride the bus.
So this was in a response to a question with someone who was clearly frustrated with the pretty significant change that the New Hanover County region has experienced over the last, say, 20 years. And I think a lot of the things that Santaguida is pointing at is sort of big picture thinking, you know, government planning, talking about, okay, let's talk about our zoning, let's talk about our comprehensive plan for the county, where do we want to put the density, how do we want to make that work with public transportation. That will not make Wilmington and New Hanover County look like it did in the late 90s, but it could alleviate a lot of the things that people complain about a lot, which is, you know, difficulty in getting to amenities or traffic.
Absolutely. She also addressed homelessness. That was one of the key questions that we asked her next.
We need to focus on housing first as a solution for homelessness, and expanding the offerings that we have here in the region in terms of supporting folks that are experiencing homelessness.
I just want to hop in here to explain housing first. This is a policy that a lot of folks who work in homeless services really support. It offers housing as a first response to homelessness without any requirements like getting off of drugs, like having any kind of job. It says the best way to address the housing crisis, to address homelessness, is to put somebody in shelter. And once you meet that base need, it's easier for them to address the other ills that they have in their life. So she's supporting housing first. We've heard from some conservatives in the community that they don't support that, folks like Luke Waddell on city council, but it's been supported by a lot of people at the local continuum of care, for example, and from a lot of other organizations and a lot of people in local government. Let's hear the rest of her answer.
We need to make sure that we have enough emergency shelter beds available for the folks that need that. It's incredibly heartbreaking to know that folks are getting turned away from emergency shelters. And then I think we also need to look at expanding permanent supportive housing options that will allow folks to move out of that emergency shelter situation into long-term, more permanent housing that allows them to build out the stability that they need to continue to move up that housing spectrum.
I must say, as a reporter who covers homelessness, this is a fairly robust and multifaceted approach to addressing homelessness, dealing with permanent supportive housing, addressing different types of homeless individuals, and recognizing that it's not always a stereotype that you're seeing in the streets. It might be a homeless family, homeless children. So this is a fairly interesting and in-depth answer, I think, from Santa Guida.
Yeah, and as you noted, it will take political will because the most effective forms of dealing with homelessness, permanent supportive housing, which gives someone a place to live immediately without making them, you know, deal with dependency issues, get clean from drugs or alcohol first, and then provides a wraparound services while they have a stable place to live, is, like I said, it's effective, it's also expensive. So the cost alone is going to be a barrier to that conversation. And then there are, as you pointed out, some conservative sort of moralizing objections to it, that people, you know, should be clean, should be sober before they get housing. It jives with what we've heard from housing experts, but the feasibility, that's going to require, that's not something she can push through on a Board of Commissioners alone. She will need help.
Moving on to our other candidate for this segment, we have John Hinnant, the one Republican who showed up to our forum. We asked him a question about whether he would support a moratorium on development. This was an audience member's question.
No, I would support increased standards for stormwater ponds. Presently, like in the city of Wilmington, a new subdivision is only required to build 25-year stormwater ponds. I would definitely support doubling that. I think that moratorium is not the solution. I think better governance is.
So this question was inspired in part by a kind of surprising move by the chairman of the Brunswick County Board of Commissioners, who floated the idea of a moratorium, which is very difficult to do legally. You just can't do this on a whim. And I think it's often tied to the inability of a county, for example, to deliver water and sewer. But this is not something you can just introduce because people don't like more development. So on that point, I think John just understands the law. But also, he's pointing at one of the main concerns he's seen in his real estate dealings when he's talking to developers. One of the things he'll tell them is, look, if you beef up your stormwater management, you're going to take care of one of the main complaints you're about to run into when you go in front of either Wilmington City Council or New Hanover County Commissioners. And so avoiding a moratorium and focusing more on the building codes is, one, something the county could do with less legal hurdles, and two, addresses a thing that he's seen in his business life.
All right, next up for John Hinnant, we asked him this question. Your top issue on your campaign site is to improve education in New Hanover County. Are you satisfied with the current performance of the local school board? Here's what he said.
Watching some of their meetings, I've been frustrated with the personalities take over, and I think that it's important that we have good decorum in those meetings. More professionalism. It's been one of the most frustrating things to watch. And so I feel like that they've made a good change with the superintendent. I think the interim superintendent seems to be doing very good. He's got a great personality. It seems like the staff is responding to him in a positive way. And so I feel like we've made a turn, and it feels like things are in the right direction. And so I don't know that we or that we are placing enough resources at our underperforming schools. And I feel like our priority of resources should be directed to those underperforming schools, either through TAs or more supplement. I think the goal should be to attract our best teachers to the lowest performing schools.
So when I asked him as a follow-up question where we would get the resources to provide more teachers into these underperforming schools and to provide more TAs at lower grade levels, this is what he said.
Getting back to the three R's, right? Writing, reading, arithmetic. I would like to see us get back to our core fundamentals. I think that's a real important thing. I think we should probably look at increasing in-classroom staff beginning at first and second grade, and then every year adding another grade, particularly in the underperforming schools.
So that's what he responded with when I asked his priorities for the schools, given that he wants to reduce spending. He did not actually address how he would pay for some of these increased resources.
So I want to take a quick moment here because John Hinnant is pointing to the very real issue of dysfunction on the school board. And in our experience with Hinnant, when he attended our forum or the Wilmington Business Journal forum, he is very cordial. He thanked the media outlets. He comes across as a very rational person with kind of middle of the road, center right responses to questions. But he has posted some more outlandish and at times controversial stuff on social media. So there's the in real life John Hinnant, and there's the very online John Hinnant. And we reached out to him about some of the, let's say it, potentially more controversial things he had posted. He did have reasonable responses for them. A lot of it centered around COVID skepticism. And he said, look, I want a conversation. I want to share some of these things. I asked him point blank if the county experienced another global health emergency. Would he trust the experts? And he said, yes. So he is not in the same category as Natasha, too, who thinks that COVID vaccines cause turbo cancers. But he did say he would ask a lot more probing questions about how the government responds and be a bit more critical and skeptical, which I think is fair, although certainly not everyone would agree with that. Some of the other things we asked him about was his back and forth with Suit Up Wilmington, which is a progressive organization here in Wilmington. He basically said that boiled down to political banter. So I understand that things get rough in politics. John said, quote, if it bothers them, they should consider wearing a helmet while participating in social media. The last question is something I got into it with him last year on Twitter, now X, about a memo he posted. This is a memo that purports to be from the head of Planned Parenthood suggesting that they would put fertility control agents in the water supply. Like all good conspiracy theories, this is a tiny little bit true. This was a memo from the late 60s put together by the man who was also the vice president of Planned Parenthood. And it was a broad spectrum report covering all the different ways you could impact fertility by the government. And it was signed explicitly that they did not endorse these. This was just, if you want to do this, these are the ways you could do it. One of those options was, putting fertility control chemicals in the water. He suggested that PFAS, chemicals like Gen X, were part of a Planned Parenthood scheme to reduce fertility, which is not true and a little crazy. Do with that what you will. I respect John for answering my questions, but it is worth noting that he has a sort of, there's a different side of his political personality online than what you see at our forum.
Well, that about wraps it up for our segment on John Hinnant. We're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back to talk about Stephanie Walker and Jonathan Barfield.
You're listening to The Newsroom. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Newsroom. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for staying with us. I'm here with my colleague Kelly Kinoyer as we continue to unpack our candidates forum for those running for the new Hanover County Board of Commissioners. And now it's time to talk about specific questions we had for Stephanie Walker, who is sort of an incumbent. People will recognize her as having served 4 years on the new Hanover County Board of Education, but she is technically a challenger in the Board of Commissioners race.
So we asked her about the idea of having a school bond that would be providing some funding for schools, specifically for some of their capital needs.
New Hanover High School, it is falling apart. I feel like someone should be, should have done something a long time ago. But the schools definitely do need help, and they are going to need a bond unless the endowment wants to pay for it.
And Stephanie Walker attended New Hanover High School. She is a local, so I think that that issue is particularly close to her heart. Obviously, laughing about the endowment providing the funding, that is something that we've heard for pretty much every issue. If only the endowment would step in.
Yeah, for what it's worth, though, the repairs or the replacement of New Hanover High School are going to be in the nine figures. So it's not a small ask.
That is certainly true. We asked her even more about school spending. So here's what we heard from her on that issue.
As a commissioner, one of my platform issues is funding public schools and supporting our schools, because I believe those are one of our core values. I think that's an economic thing as well. There's a lot of data that shows that if you support kids very early on, that really runs through their whole lives. The second one is literacy at all levels. The third one is culture and climate of our schools. And the fourth is supporting college hope program.
One thing I will note is that economic issue that Walker brought up. She dug into that a little bit more. She mentioned that investing in the schools is investing in our future economy. It's getting workers who are well-educated and prepared for the workforce, who might be more interested in staying in the Wilmington, New Hanover County area if they feel like there are prospects for them here, and if they feel that they've been treated well and well-prepared by the local school district.
Yes, a significant chunk of school funding comes from the state, but the local supplement from the county makes up a big part of it. For every student, it's in the ballpark of $9,000 from the state and $3,000 to $4,000 from the county. And it's a significant role that they play in school funding.
And if I recall correctly, it's a big part of whether or not teachers are paid a substantial amount. There's a certain amount that they're required to be paid by the state, but if local government wants to supplement that, that is on the county typically to supplement teacher pay. So this is something that comes up quite a lot. Next up, we have Walker talking about growth and development. Here is her answer on that issue on how this county should grow.
I think that if we did have a robust transportation system, a lot more people would use it, and that would help a lot. So I just think that we do need to invest in a public transportation system, but we have to have the political will to do it.
So the data shows that if people are going to be what are called choice riders, where they have a car but they choose to take public transportation, it's got to be pretty convenient. And that does mean a robust investment, because you need more buses, more drivers, more frequent route stops. And so that will obviously take political will. So she's, in my opinion, spot on that, if that's a thing you want to do.
I will say, though, this was related to growth and development. When we've asked these questions to Walker, she's often talked about impacts of traffic, seeing environmental impacts. One of the main things that county commissioners do in this state is manage development, say yes or no to specific projects. And what we're hearing from Walker is that she's thinking more about public transit and the impacts of development. So I'm curious, seeing what she's talked about here, what she would say yes to, what she would not say yes to. And I don't have a clear vision on that from her answers from this forum.
Yeah, and it's worth pointing out the way the county approves development is in a piecemeal fashion. Now, they can and should have an overall plan of what they want the county to look like. That's the comprehensive plan, with areas where they think, you know, commerce should go, where they think residential should go, what they think should be preserved as green space. But what comes to them, you know, during a meeting is one project at one location with neighbors who probably don't want to see dense development. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And that's what candidates, not just in this race, but in the City of Wilmington race last year and races as long as I can remember, that's what candidates tend to shy away from directly engaging with, because that's where the real pushback from the voters comes from.
I will say that what Walker did talk about somewhat is living in the Ogden area and not being happy about seeing the development that she's seen in that area. So that is probably something that speaks to how she will vote on the commission if she gets there. Next up, and finally, we have candidate and incumbent Jonathan Barfield. We asked him several questions related to the endowment, starting with what he thinks of the endowment's current leadership, given that the county commissioners are the ones who select who ends up at the endowment.
The reality is Commissioner Zappel and myself have never weighed in not one time on who's been appointed to the endowment. Three commissioners have sat together and made a decision on who they're going to appoint without any transparency whatsoever. And that's, in my opinion, why we've gotten into the place that we are now, with staff resigning, the CEO leaving the organization as well, because of the inner turmoil. The last time that William Buster spoke to our board of commissioners, I was very critical of the work that the endowment had been doing with their first round of investments in our community. Over $20-some million given to UNCW and Kafer Community College, when the intent, in my opinion, as one of those that voted to sell the hospital as part of the initial conversation, was to help fund our local nonprofits, to put money into affordable housing and the things that the grassroots organizations that make our community run and grow and go. And instead, giving money to state institutions when they have resources coming from the state level, to me, was a total dereliction of duty.
So there's a lot to unpack here, probably too much for this show, so we'll have links to some of the history of the hospital sale and the creation of the endowment. But some of the things that Barfield is referencing here include the conservative majority on the Board of Commissioners appointing a number of people to the endowment, really without any public conversation. He's also referencing William Buster, the former CEO and president of the endowment, who's pushed out. And Barfield was pretty critical of the largest grant that Buster oversaw, which was a $22 million grant that went to the school district and Cape Fear Community College and UNCW to create a nursing pipeline. And critics were quick to note that this would benefit Novant. It basically took money that Novant had paid to get the hospital and put it back into a system that was going to benefit them. And Barfield's criticism was that this was taking a huge amount of essentially public money and putting it into large institutions that already had reliable funding streams, while smaller nonprofits throughout the New Hanover County region were basically struggling to keep the lights on.
And I will say, speaking about those appointments, who's ended up on this board, it's true that originally when this endowment board was created, a lot of the appointments were fairly apolitical. It was a spectrum of different people from different parts of the community, all pretty well connected, but different political ideologies. And that has changed in recent years. We've had Woody White added to it. Pat Cusick was on and then decided to step off. We've had much more conservatives appointed to this board, and that has been done by the conservatives on the Board of Commissioners. So this is an interesting and kind of spicy take from Jonathan Barfield. But speaking of the endowment, we also decided to ask Barfield about the hospital sale itself. That was a fairly controversial take at the time, and he is the only remaining member of the Board of Commissioners who voted in favor of it. So we asked him whether he regretted that issue, and he said that it was the right call at the time.
The former lease that we had with New Hanover did not allow them to build outside of our county. They couldn't borrow money and build outside of our county, and they were concerned about another hospital coming in and taking the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, where they may be doing knee surgeries or back surgeries and taking some of the profit margins from the local hospital here. So giving them the ability to expand outside of our region would allow the hospital to grow, and that's when the conversation around the sale took place. And again, I do stand behind that decision to sell the hospital.
And he did tie that back to investments that have been made in the community in health, things like the two Michael Jordan clinics that are going up in the downtown part of the area. He said that this sale would improve health equity in the region.
Yeah, and that was a big part of the push when the sale happened. And again, Barfield's description of the logic behind the sale tracks with almost everyone I spoke with back in 2019, so I don't think he's misrepresenting it. Everyone might disagree on the details, but I think he's painting an accurate picture. One of the things that was on the table was it wasn't just the sale price. It wasn't just the $2-some billion that Novant was going to give the county, although that certainly dazzled plenty of people. Novant also promised to put over $3 billion into the community, and that meant new facilities, but also, you know, things like the Michael Jordan clinics that he's talking about. Now, when we asked Barfield a follow-up, if he thought Novant has lived up to every one of those promises, and we've had some reporting on that that suggests they haven't, he agreed. He said they haven't lived up to every single one of their promises, contractual promises, not just handshake deals. And he said they have been having conversations about those issues. And so just put a pin in that, because I'd like to hear more about that.
That is absolutely true. And that wraps up our coverage of this candidate forum. Thank you so much for listening.
And of course, we encourage you to watch the whole show, because there's a lot going on that we didn't get to. We try to hit the highlights. And also, you can appreciate WECT's John Evans MC skills, always an important part of our forums. But for now, Kelly Kinoyer, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this edition of The Newsroom. Thanks to WECT and Port City Daily for joining us for another year of candidates' forums, and to the candidates themselves who joined us, Jonathan Barfield, Stephanie Walker, John Hinnant, and Cassidy Santaguida. And a special thanks to Cape Fear Community College for once again providing a wonderful space to hold these important civic events. Thanks to my colleague Kelly Kinoyer for joining us today, and Ken Campbell for technical support. If you missed any part of this show, you can find it at whqr.org or as a podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. If you have comments, questions, or an idea for a future show, let us know at newsroom@whqr.org. Just a note, early voting kicked off this week and continues through Saturday, November 2nd, and Election Day is Tuesday, November 5th. You can find voting information, details on the new voter ID law, and lots more on candidates for races around the Cape Fear region, all that at whqr.org. I'm Ben Schachman. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll join us for the next edition of The Newsroom.